Hi everyone, I'm here today with David Glover. He's the joint CEO at Caremark. Hi David, thanks so much for joining.
Doug, thanks for asking me to be part of it today.
No, it's great. It's great. It's a Monday. We're just talking about it. So it's a Monday and normally, yeah, everyone's pretty busy on Monday. So I appreciate you giving a bit of your time to this.
It's all right, pleasure.
Just to start off with, can you tell me and our audience a bit about who Caremark are and what you offer your customers slash clients?
So Caremark, we are a domiciliary care franchise. So it's basically our franchisees providing care to people in their own homes. And that care can range from personal care through to companionship or respite care. As a business, we are the sixth largest home care business, both within franchising and non-franchise businesses. Turnover last year, £126 million. And we look after about 8,000 customers and employ through our network, 6,000 plus care staff.
Great. All right. That's great. David, I had a question about care, right? Because there's so many care businesses out there and such a focus on care and the aging population and so on. And I would say in franchising especially, the care sector's been a kind of a hot sector, if you like, for people showing interest in it as a business model for a long time now. And that doesn't show any it doesn't show any signs of slowing down. I just want to get your view on care homes versus in-home care, because all I seem to see these days is care at home and in-home care. And I totally get it, right? I think anyone with and everyone's got elderly parents and so on. Everyone can see the advantages of in-home care. What's actually happening in the UK at the moment? Like, are care homes going totally out of fashion? Is there still a place for them? What's the kind of the balance between in-home care these days and actually a care home? What's your take on all of that?
Yes, I think there always is going to be a demand for residential care. I think that home care, however, is the preferred option for people that know about it. I think too many people still don't know about the benefits of home care. But from a customer perspective, it's cheaper. But more importantly for that, customers want to be in their own homes. People don't want to go into residential care settings. And you also saw during COVID the issues of being in a care home, in terms of COVID spreading very quickly within care homes, relatives being unable to see their loved ones in a care home setting. So I think there are a huge amount of advantages to residential, sorry, domiciliary care over care homes, but certainly, I see a demand for care homes still existing. And I think that both sectors can work alongside each other.
Yeah. Okay. No. Thanks, David. It's good to get your take on that. And David, I wanted to go back. I was just looking over your LinkedIn, which I have to say, firstly, your LinkedIn profile is a brilliantly laid out LinkedIn profile. I look at a lot of LinkedIn profiles. Yours is one of the best I've seen, honestly, David. So well done on that.
Thank you.
It
I did
really.
get some help on it though, so I can't confess it's all my own work.
Do you know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't. You recognize that it needed to be set out in the way that it is. So that's all credit. I really, it makes it so much easier for me to go through and when I ask questions and things. But I saw on there that you started as a solicitor involved in franchising, and that was kind of early 90s. So I just wanted to. I wanted to go back to that period and kind of understand a bit more about your background, your qualifications, and that whole legal side of things, in the beginning.
I did a degree in law and business studies. So it was always my aim to go into law, but I had a business interest, which is why I did the joint degree. I made a conscious decision. I didn't want to go and work in the city. I wanted to have quality of life. So I joined a large regional practice as a trainee solicitor or an article clerk, as it was called in those days. And the firm I joined just so happened to be affiliate members of the British Franchise Association. The person heading up the franchising department at the time was actually Nina Moran Watson. So she left actually shortly before I joined. So we never worked at the same time. But after I qualified, so you did 2 years as a trainee solicitor. And after I qualified, I was asked to head up the franchising department And I absolutely jumped at it. You know, I'd done a bit during my training contract with the firm, loved it, loved the idea. And what we did is we actually set up something quite unique within franchising at that time. We acted for a number of franchisors and franchisees. And rather than me just advising franchisees on the franchise agreement, I also did the commercial property aspect of it. So it was quite unique having that one-stop shop for franchisees, whereby they didn't get passed from one person in the law firm to another. So I could advise franchisees taking on a lease of a shop and look at the commercialness of that and advising on that, as well as reviewing the franchise agreement. So it was quite unique at that point in time. And I did that. I qualified and I spent 2 years heading up the franchising department. And as I said, you know, working with some really large franchisors and working for franchisees as well.
And so, I mean, it's a brilliant grounding in franchising to come from a legal, you know, the legal aspect, because that's a big part of it, of course. And it helps you to understand the relationship between franchisor and franchisee when you understand franchise agreements and how they put together and how they're written and all of that. But how did that come to an end? Because you're not a practicing solicitor anymore, right? What did you lose interest in that, or did you just have bigger aspirations, or what happened?
Actually, I renewed my practice certificate earlier this year. So I'm now back on the solicitor's role. And the reason I did that is because we're looking at bringing somebody in to head up a legal department within here at Caremark. And I just wanted to have that practicing solicitor back again so that I could actually run the department and look after it. So for the first time in 25 odd years, I'm now back on the role. But in answer to your question as to why I moved on, I think that I was in 1996, I was named in Chambers as one of the top franchise solicitors in the country, along with people like Mazur Hissani and people like that. And I felt that I actually, in a very short space of time, achieved quite a lot. I was also quite bored. I didn't enjoy wading through leases or contracts. I felt that I was much more of a people person. I enjoyed getting out there and networking and meeting people. And my biggest client was Subway. Subway came to the UK. The second time, they actually came in the late 80s, early 90s, but failed. They came back and they opened their first store in Brighton, which is where I was based. And I got the work for the franchisee. And so did all their lease and advised them on the franchise agreement. And through that, I got to know Subway very well. And eventually I got Subway's legal work. So I was acting for doing a lot of legal work for Subway and built good relationships with the team at Subway out in America. And there, European operations director approached me one day and said, look, have you ever thought about buying the master license or development area agreements for parts of the UK? Because Subway split the UK into about 10 different area development license agreements. And I said, yeah, I'd love to, but I'm 26 years old. You know, I haven't got the money to invest in that. And she said, well, look, I know some high worth individuals in America that are looking to invest in Subway. How about I put you in touch with them and see where the conversation goes? So that's what happened. I met with a group of five, you know, quite high worth individuals in Miami. They decided they liked me and I liked them. We bought two development rights. So Surrey, Kent and Essex and Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, Hertfordshire and Oxfordshire, and bought those. And we opened our first Subway, which was the third Subway in the UK, in Southend-on-Sea. Much to my parents' annoyance, when I told my mother that I was quitting being a solicitor to go and make sandwiches, she actually went and stood outside the Subway in Brighton, would you believe, and carried out market research on her own and came back and told me it was never going to work. I was stupid, but people weren't prepared to spend that type of money on a submarine sandwich. And that was her advice to me, to stay being a solicitor. But I ignored it and I was glad I did.
Wow. So the third Subway in the UK.
Yeah, wow. In Southend-on-Sea. And, you know, it was hugely challenging because as part of the development agreement you had with Subway, before that development agreement kicked in, you had to show that you could own and operate your own store.
Yeah.
And you had to do that for a minimum of 6 months. And at that point in time, nobody had heard of Subway. The only people that heard of it were people that had holidayed in America. And we were very lucky in Southend, and I think there's some similarity here with Brighton as well, that The majority of our business came between 10 o'clock in the evening and 3 in the morning on a Friday and Saturday when people were getting kicked out of pubs. We had a late night refreshment house license, as they called it in those days, that enabled us to stay open. And that enabled us to get that foothold to actually make a success of that business. I think that if we didn't have that sort of nightclub trade, it would have been very difficult to get a foothold in the market in Southend.
Okay. And so you were part of that kind of master licensee with Subway for what, 5 years?
Yeah, just under, yeah. So we grew it. So we, by the end of it, we had 4 company-owned stores. And we had about 11 or 12 franchised offices or franchise stores, should I say, in the home counties.
Okay.
Including one, which was amazing, on a US Air Force base at RAF Lakenheath, which was just phenomenal. When we first opened that, they warned me how busy it was going to be, but people were queuing for up to 3 hours to get a sandwich. It was just phenomenal.
Because they knew the brand, right, as well, very well.
Yeah, and it's a taste of home for them. You know, they're American citizens. They haven't got that sort of... And it was just fantastic to be able to serve, you know, the American community there. And it was hugely successful, that store.
So David, how did that kind of whole relationship and stuff that was going on with Subway, how did that come to an end? And where did you go next?
It came to an end. I mean, it was hugely challenging. When I, you know, talked about the nighttime work, when I went to bed, I lived where I live now, so near Worthing, West Sussex, and we had our stores in Southend and Lakenheath, which is in Suffolk, huge distance travel. I go to bed at sort of 11 o'clock at night, and I knew my phone would ring. There would be something wrong, you know. Somebody's done this. Somebody's been pushed through the window. Somebody's stolen this, or the till system's gone down. And it became hugely draining. And to do all the traveling, I just felt that I'd sort of burnt myself out. I'd been working at all ends of the candle. And I just felt the time was right to move on. I had an offer to sell, which was a very attractive offer. And I just thought, you know what, I just fancy taking the money. And I took a year out. So took time out and did a bit of traveling, had a bit of me time. I'd never had a gap year when I was at university or done anything like that. So at sort of 30 years old, or just shy of that, to be able to take a year out and have the money and resources to do that and put a bit of money, you know, in the bank, that was a very attractive thing to me.
But you weren't put off franchising, right? Because you came back and got involved with Mailbox. Is that right?
Yeah. I joined Mailboxes. I joined them there, looking after their franchise recruitment and also new store opening. I had the really lucky experience to work with a gentleman called Chris Gillam. Chris had been around franchising for a long, long time, and learned a lot from Chris as well. So that helped supplement my knowledge. And I really enjoyed working at Mailboxes, working with Chris. They were good times working there.
And was that an employed role or a consultancy role, David? Because obviously you had a lot of experience at that point as a master licensee or area developer with Subway. And so how did that role look?
Yeah, it was an employed role. So and it was actually quite challenging sometimes to get back into it franchising. People weren't keen to take me on after I'd had that experience of being the master licensee, working for myself. I remember going along for one interview with a franchisor who's no longer around these days, but they said, "You've been successful once. How do I know you've got the fire in your belly to be successful again?" And I said, "Well, do you want to hire somebody that's not been successful then?" So it was challenging to get back in. But I said, working alongside Chris Gillam was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed that and learned a lot from Chris.
Yeah. Oh, great. And then, so next, and this is where you moved to, you got involved with Max Service Departments, and you were there quite a long time, 10 years, I think.
Yeah. So I was commercial director there. So really number two in the company. So we started up Max Service Departments, which is an apart hotel, or in America, they call it extended stay accommodation. Relatively new concept in the UK then, and probably still is actually. In America, it accounts for around about 25% of all hotel beds in America. And all the big players do it. So you've got IHG with Candlewood and Staybridge, you know, Hilton have got their own brand, Marriott have got Residence Inn. So it's huge. And what it is it's looking at people that are longer term hotel stays, so mainly 7 or 9 nights or more. So people on training courses, people on secondment somewhere, or people, you know, that have had to move out of home because of flooding or insurance purposes. So it's extended stay accommodation. It's accommodation that's got a that's based on a hotel, but it's got a kitchen facility, a lounge area, typically in a separate bedroom area. So we started that off and we opened up 10 locations in the UK. We also built hotels from scratch for some of the major players. So we built a couple of hotels for Radisson. So we had a 200-bed hotel in Bristol that we built for them and Cardiff, and also had a couple of hotels with Radisson in Brighton. And they were either done via management agreements or franchise agreements. So still keeping my hand in to some degree within franchising. But yeah, again, really interesting to get involved in the hotel and the hospitality industry, because that was quite different and unique from mailboxes was retail, Subway was fast food, and then to get involved in hospitality again, that's still franchising to some degrees, but a different slant on it, different perspective, and dealing with, you know, really big franchisors in terms of Radisson and Marriott's and people like that.
Yeah. So then what happened after that? Because that's when you joined Caremark. And to tell me how that happened. How did Caremark come into your life, David?
I think the time was right to move on from Max Service Apartments. I think that relationship had run its course. I think I was finding it quite frustrating there. I think that values didn't align particularly. I think that their growth was funded from existing portfolios. So the growth was being funded by draining existing businesses dry to fund the growth, which made that very, very challenging. And they weren't reinvesting in the business. So I just felt the time was right to move on. And actually, Chris Gillam did consultancy work by this point in time. And Chris was on board with Caremark to do franchise recruitment. And just after he agreed to come on and do that, or around about the same time, I think, he had an offer to go in as MD at Gino. And he decided to take the Gino job. And he put a good word in for me with Kevin Lewis, who owned Caremark at the time, and said, "Kevin, look, really sorry, but you know, I've got this great opportunity I can't turn down. But the good news is I know somebody that can do a fantastic job for you as well." And he put me in touch with Kevin. I met with Kevin. And as I say, the rest is history.
The rest is history. And where was Caremark in those early days? So that was like a decade ago. And where has Caremark gone in that time? Like, how would you summarize that, the growth, I suppose?
Yeah, I think over the 10 years, we've had steady growth. I think that Caremark has a very good reputation within the industry. I think we have a really good group of franchise owners. I think we have an engaged group of franchise owners and always have. I think that what happened was, unfortunately, Kevin passed away very suddenly in September 21. And Kevin was larger than life. Kevin was hugely entrepreneurial. Kevin was in the business for all the right reasons. He cared passionately about the delivery of care and as many business people benefiting from Caremark's quality of care. But I think it's also fair to say that, you know, Lisa and myself, so Lisa Fife, who's the joint CEO, and you know, Kevin died and the shares in the company were left to his 4 children and equal shares. And the children asked Lisa and myself to step up, the joint CEOs. I think Lisa and I had a vision and the ability to make certain changes or tweaks, should we say, to the model. And I think that the last 2.5 years have seen significant changes for us. I think, you know, we've invested very, very heavily in the business. And we have the support of the family, which is great. And the family lead Lisa and myself to basically do the day-to-day running of the business. So we've seen areas that we can improve. We've invested, as I said, very heavily. And I think that Caremark is a slightly different animal to what it was 2.5 years ago. I think that we're seeing significant growth. Last year, we saw network growth increase by 18% year on year, which is great. I've got a network of franchise owners that I'm very proud of, and I'm very lucky to work alongside. And I think that, you know, we're in a really good place, and I, you know, we want to be challenging. We want to be challenging In the franchising world, we're number three behind Home Instead and Bluebird. And we want to be challenging those guys and moving the business forward, both in terms of number of offices and in terms of, you know, number of hours of care being delivered, number of customers you look after, but always focusing and remaining focused on the quality of the care that you deliver.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, just with all of your years of experience in franchising, but primarily talking about Caremark, communication between the franchisor and the franchisee is absolutely key and fundamental, really, in making everything else happen. Well, how do you view that, and how do you ensure that it's where you want it to be? You know, you're obviously a people person, but communication, it can be done in a good way or a bad way, and so I just wanted to understand how you I guess your approach or your philosophy towards that at Caremark.
I think communication, I think it has to be open. I think it has to be honest. I think it has to be transparent. I think the most important thing is to engage with people. I think the worst thing you can do is not engage. I think that in terms of communication, it has to be collaborative, not dictatorial. So we've recently introduced a national marketing fund here. And you'll know from your experience how difficult it is to introduce it mid-life cycle of a franchisor. We had over 75% of our network agree to it and sign up to it with a 1% contribution. And we did that through open communication, engaging with our franchisees, discussing it all. And it took us 6 months to do it. But that was a huge amount of meetings and listening as well. Got to listen. You know, listen to what your franchisees are telling you, because it has to be a relationship that works for both parties. Both parties have to win in the relationship. And as I said, I think listening and I think being open and honest with your franchisees is the best form of communication.
Yeah, and you know, the national marketing fund and introducing that, as you say, midterm is really, really difficult to do. I'd say you've done very well to get that over the line in 6 months, let alone at all, because I've seen that kind of thing fail many times in networks. So I think that's testament to the relationship that's there. And in terms of just that, how does that transparency then go back to the franchisees when you're talking about, yes, a 1% contribution that's being spent centrally, decisions are made centrally, of course, there's collaboration. But what insight do you give back to the network as to where that money is being spent and how it ultimately helps the brand and them as well?
So as part of the process, what we have said is that we have a consultative group. So a consultative group made up of eight of our franchisees that we meet with on a regular basis. And what we have said is we will go to that consultative group with our marketing plan, and we will meet with them twice a year. And we will ask for feedback on that plan. We will listen to that feedback. Ultimately, the decision will rest with us as the franchisor. But I guarantee you and them that we will absolutely listen to their feedback, and we will tweak it, we will alter it, we will change it, because they have to be on board with what we're spending and how we're spending it. So firstly, I think it's consulting with our network via our consultative group. And what we've also said is at the end of the year, we will account for everything we've spent. So we'll give them accounts for it. And the other thing I've said is that we will spend all our money actually on marketing activities. What we are not going to do is it's not going to pay the cost of salaries of our marketing team. This is pure marketing spend. And as I said, we'll be very open and disclose everything to them. We'll keep the money in a separate account. I think that is one of the reasons that franchisees were willing and happy to sign up to it, because of those promises that we made to them that we will absolutely keep.
Yeah, no, absolutely, David. And I think you're right. Transparency and collaboration are really important. And do you, the franchisees that, if you like, form the head of the spear, they're the ones that you communicate. Do you call them a franchise council, or how do you position them? What's how do you choose them?
It's a consultative group. So it's made up. We split the UK into five regions from a support perspective, and we have our field team. So we have a quality manager and a regional support manager in each of those five regions. So each of those five regions has elected one representative to the consultative group. They stand for a two-year term. In addition to that, we have a representative of a small business, a medium-sized business, and a large business. And again, elected every 2 years. And they're elected intervening years so that you never change the whole consultant group every year. You've always got that continuity, which I think is really important. So it is up for elections. Sometimes it's difficult to find franchisees that want to put themselves up for election, but we do have 8 people there. So that is our consultative group. And that works really well for us. It's a very open meeting that we have with the franchise owners at that meeting. In addition, we also have what we call our 360 group. So that is a group for our franchisees with a turnover in excess of £3 million per year. And we meet with them a couple of times a year as well to get feedback from them, to understand the challenges in their business, because the challenges a franchise owner has in a business with a turnover in excess of £3 million is very different to the challenges a new franchisee has. And there are learnings to be had from us as a franchisor as to what our top franchisees are doing in their business. And it's our way of engaging with our top franchise owners. So again, it's not a closed shop. So as soon as a franchisee hits £3 million, they get invited to the 360. And that takes the form of a meeting in London, typically, and then a night out with dinner. So it's a nice work social type event. And again, we use the consultative group and the 360 group to consult with on our marketing plans and discuss that with both those groups of people before we actually rolled out a final proposal when we introduced it.
That's brilliant to hear that you do that, because so many franchisors that we come across and work with have problems when it comes to those franchisees that have become really successful, super successful, and they've almost outgrown the need to be a franchisee. Well, in their heads they have, right? And lots of franchisors just don't quite know how to deal with them. They leave them be a lot of the time. They don't try and collaborate. They certainly don't push too much compliance on them, as long as they're respecting the boundaries of things. But I think that's a mistake. I think what you're doing is absolutely right. You need to put them into a different category, recognize them for who they are, and draw on what they learn in their businesses and what they can bring to the franchise network as a whole, and let that filter down. And I think that I just see so many franchisors create a problem for themselves by not doing that. So, you know, that's really, really interesting. How long has that been happening at Caremark, David? Has that been going on a long time? Is that quite a new idea?
Yeah. So we introduced it about 18 months ago. So it's one of the initiatives that Lisa and myself introduced. I think it was a good way of engaging with our top performing franchisees. And as I said, Doug, it's a learning curve for both parties, and you're never too old or too ugly enough to learn. So I think that's really important, and it's a two-way street, and it is very important for us to engage for all those reasons that you just expanded upon.
Okay. So I just wanted to ask, in your kind of 3 decades, I suppose, plus in franchising now, and either in a business sense with Caremark or maybe personally, what's been the biggest kind of hurdle that you feel that you've personally overcome during that time? Just generally, it can be anything.
I think from my perspective, bear in mind I started running my own business at Subway when I was 26 years old, which was very young. I think the biggest thing I've ever learned is about how to manage and lead teams of people. I think that, especially at Subway, where you've got staff there that are quite young, poorly paid, relatively speaking, and getting them to come into work at 10 o'clock on a Friday night when they sooner be actually at the nightclub rather than serving people that come out of the nightclub, that's challenging. And I had a fellow director, and I learned a huge amount from him as to how to manage people. And I think one thing I'll always think about my career is actually I think about people I've worked with, from the senior partner in the law firm. I still think to myself, even now, what would Don do in this situation? And I think that to me is the important thing, is about learning and taking on board things and never standing still. You always can improve. And I think, as I said, learning management skills, how to deal with people, how people are very different, how to motivate people, how to inspire people, how to lead teams of people. I really wish I knew now what I knew when I was at Subway, because that was a huge issue in terms of being so young and running a business and employing people that were a lot older than you a lot of the time.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of people can relate to that. And the last question I had for you today was just franchising in general. What do you believe is the biggest challenge faced in creating a successful franchise brand? Because you've seen the challenges, you've been involved in lots of different sectors with lots of companies and franchise businesses. So, yeah, if you, and it doesn't have to be one answer, but biggest challenges, let's say, in creating a successful franchise brand?
I think there are a number of challenges. I mean, I think firstly, one of the most important things, and it's very close to my heart, is I think the reality has to meet expectation. So I think that when you are starting off and when you are selling new franchises, what you say to people during that process has to meet the expectation. And for existing franchise owners, if you say you're going to do something or something's happening, that's got to happen. You know, if you tell a franchisee that you meet, we support you and we do this and we do that, you know, you're setting yourself up. You've got to make sure that you fulfill that. What you don't want to do is give false expectations to franchise owners, because you're just storing up problems. And also it's about recruiting the right franchisees in the first place. You know, it's especially when you start off, it's very tempting to sell franchises to people that you know don't necessarily share the same values as you. You maybe don't think they're going to be as successful as you would hope they would be, but you're desperate to sell a franchise. And I would say to anybody, you know, make sure you sell a franchise or reward a franchise, which is really where you should be looking at it, to the right people from the off. Because all you're doing is storing up problems if you're selling or awarding a franchise to somebody that you don't feel is a fit for you. I think the other thing that's really important is consistency. You know, a consistency of brand, consistent message, you know, whether it be Subway. You know, if you walk into a Subway, that sandwich is the same or should be the same from one Subway to the next. In terms of care, Mark, that delivery of care, that quality of the care should be exactly the same. And the brand should become synonymous with that quality. So consistency, consistency of marketing materials as well. Make sure that you develop your brand, because if you have inconsistency in your marketing collateral, you know, you're going to struggle really to develop a brand. All the great brands out there have consistency in brand. So that's really important. And that's something we've worked on very hard over the last couple of years. You know, we've got a marketing team here now that have introduced tools for our franchise owners to allow them to be able to create marketing material that's all consistent and on brand. And also, I think from our perspective, especially in the industry we're in, quality of the service that you provide. You know, it has to be the highest quality. You know, we as a business are looking after vulnerable individuals, and people need to know that Caremark stands for quality of care, quality of service, and that they can rely upon it. So I think that all those things are really important in challenges that need to be faced. And it's too easy sometimes to get away from that. And it takes a lot, huge degree of sort of determination, clear vision and strategy. You know, we now have a 5-year plan here, which we never had before. So we're all aligned, both us and our franchise owners. And that's the other important thing, to have an alignment between you and your franchise owners, and engage and a positive network, because as a business, you want to be rowing in the same direction. Yes, you know, you'll have disagreements, but I think that as long as you all get working towards the same common goal, I think you're halfway there, though.
Yeah, David, I think that's a brilliant summary. And the word I took from that, and it really does sum up franchising pretty well, is consistency. Because if you were to say what is franchising in one word, in the way that we know it, consistency is a great word to describe it throughout every aspect of the model. And so well, David, thanks so much for your time. I'll let you go now, and I'm sure we'll bump into each other at one of the franchise events later on in the year.
Look forward to that. And thanks for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Cheers for now, David. Bye.
Bye.